The Argonauts begins with a confession of love on a cement floor in October 2007. Like the mythical ship Argo, whose parts were gradually replaced while maintaining its name, these three words, "I love you," require constant renewal to retain their meaning. This tension between permanence and transformation forms the philosophical backbone of this extraordinary memoir. When Nelson sends her partner Harry a Roland Barthes passage about this very concept after her first love confession, she establishes the book's central question: how do we maintain identity through transformation? Their relationship begins with passionate disagreements about language itself, Nelson championing its kaleidoscopic potential, while Harry warns of its cookie-cutter function. These philosophical battles reveal how language both liberates and constrains us in our quest for connection and understanding. By February 2008, Nelson was apartment hunting with Harry and his 3-year-old son. They found a Mountain View house and slept on the bare floor, dreaming of their future. Nelson describes folding tiny socks, making cocoa, and playing Fallen Soldier, where she sprinkled healing dust on Harry's son as the Blue Witch. These intimate moments unfolded against California's Proposition 8 campaign to ban same-sex marriage, with Yes on Prop 8 signs on the mountain reminding them of opposition to families like theirs. Their family faced criticism from both conservatives denying their validity and radical queer perspectives questioning their heteronormative choices. When a friend dismissively labels a family photo mug as heteronormative, Nelson questions what makes it so: their holiday traditions, her pregnancy, their desire to document family life. Through experiences from marrying before Prop 8 passed to creating unique bedtime rituals, Nelson reveals how building a family becomes both personal joy and political resistance. Nelson explores sodomitical maternity, the radical notion that mothers can maintain their sexuality, including non-normative desires, while parenting. She challenges the cultural binary positioning femininity and reproduction against sexuality and queer resistance. When Nelson and her infant are turned away from a friend's burlesque show because babies might remind patrons of their own children, she recognizes what Susan Freeman describes as heroic gay male sexuality as a stand-in for queerness, which remains unpolluted by procreative femininity. Artist A.L. Steiner's 2012 installation, Puppies and Babies, offers a joyful alternative, an anarchic collection showing friends in various states of intimacy with puppies and babies. The images celebrate caretaking detached from gender: naked women with dogs, nursing babies, one while doing a handstand, pregnant women together, another in leather dom gear. Unlike feminists who've downplayed childbearing's erotics, Puppies and Babies embraces the messy perversities of all bodies, presenting queer family making as the umbrella category under which baby making might be a subset. Summer 2011, Nelson was 4 months pregnant while Harry was 6 months on testosterone. Their bodies transformed simultaneously but differently. Nelson's increasingly read as female, while Harry's increasingly read as male. They travel to Fort Lauderdale for Harry's top surgery, creating an extraordinary scene. Nelson watching Diana Nyad's swim attempt while Harry emerged from surgery with drains filling with cherry Kool-Aid-colored blood. Nelson initially worried about Harry's transition, reading pamphlets about what might change on T. When she expressed health concerns, suggesting, "You already pass 90% of the time without tea," Harry simply responded, "I need your support." The changes brought Harry peace. His only regret was waiting so long. When Nelson injects Harry's testosterone, she feels she's delivering a gift. Meanwhile, Nelson's pregnant body undergoes its own transformation. The cartilage nub where my ribs used to fit together, the rearrangement of organs. She gains 54 pounds growing her son, a number that appalled her mother but gave Nelson pleasure of late-breaking disobedience. Through these parallel journeys, Nelson shows how all bodies constantly change, dissolving the binary between natural and unnatural modifications. Nelson confronts cultural discomfort with pregnant women who maintain intellectual lives, At a prestigious university talk, a playwright asks how she handled working on dark material in My Condition. She thinks, leave it to the patrician white guy to call the lady speaker back to her body, that wild oxymoron, the pregnant woman who thinks. This captures the persistent belief that pregnancy compromises intellectual capacity. After returning to work post-baby, a superior mentions a professor whose research interests disappeared for 2 years after childbirth, but then came back with a knowing wink. This echoes psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott's patronizing view that mothers will not be able to fight for her rights because she will not understand. Nelson questions why the most respected childcare books are written by men. Even in The Baby Book by William and Martha Sears, the nurse, wife, mother's voice appears only in anecdotes and sidebars. Through her own example, writing profound theory while pregnant and parenting, Nelson demonstrates that motherhood doesn't diminish thinking, but provides new insights about embodiment, dependency, and care that enrich her philosophical perspective. Nelson's descriptions of childbirth and Harry's account of his mother's death create a profound meditation on the boundary between life and death. Labor isn't something you do, it does you, demanding surrender, running over you like a truck with no safe word. In successful births, the baby emerges alive, and so do you, but you touch death along the way. Nelson recounts her labor, counting through contractions, breathing, vomiting. After 24 hours and Pitocin, her water breaks. When the urge to push arrives suddenly, after several pushes, she feels her son come out all at once. Iggy arrives perfect, with my mouth screaming. Meanwhile, Harry sits with his dying mother, telling her it's okay to go. Stepping outside briefly, he smells honeysuckle and sees fireflies, then returns to stay with her. He touches her from feet to head, kisses her bald head, and says goodnight. Later, he watches her eyes open, illuminated, as she passes at 2:16 a.m. These parallel experiences reveal birth and death as sacred thresholds, where time slows and ordinary reality recedes. Nelson reflects, people say women forget labor pain, but it's not the pain we forget, it's the touching death part. Nelson explores psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott's concept of holding, the physical and psychological environment a caregiver creates. When this environment fails, a child experiences primitive agonies like falling forever or disintegration. While a baby doesn't literally die when its holding environment fails, it may die and die and die. Nelson extends this concept beyond parent-child relationships to partnerships and communities. She describes holding her son Iggy in the dark underspace of the bottom bunk, while acknowledging moments when Iggy's small body holds mine. This mutual holding challenges our cultural emphasis on independence. Nelson admits she learned to scorn dependence, deriving self-worth from hyper-competence and irrational belief in my self-reliance. Through motherhood and partnership, she comes to value interdependence. This self, without sympathetic attachments, is fiction or lunacy. Like the Argonauts replacing their ship's parts while sailing, we remake ourselves through daily acts of care. The greatest freedom isn't independence, but acknowledging our interdependence to hold and be held by those we love.